The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are courts going to resolve disputes between the executive and the legislative branch? Are courts going to involve themselves in the internal rulemaking processes of Congress?
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 11th, 2020. Last week, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington handed down a major unbanked decision in the case of Don McGahn. You remember that case. It's the question of whether the president's former White House counsel even needs to show up in response to a congressional subpoena, or whether he has absolute immunity from testifying before Congress. A strong 7-judge majority of the D.C. Circuit overturned a panel opinion that had held that a congressional committee had no standing to sue to enforce its subpoena. Yes, the full D.C. Circuit ruled it does have standing. In a separate case, a lower court ruled on an internecine dispute within the House of Representatives over proxy voting instituted by Speaker Nancy Pelosi in response to the COVID crisis. The court ruled that Republicans could not challenge the proxy voting rule because of the speech and debate clause. Joining me to talk over the action in federal courts vis-a-vis Congress were Lawfare senior editors Margaret Taylor and Scott Anderson. We connected in the virtual jungle studio to talk about what this all means for congressional oversight. Will these opinions stand up on further review, and what will happen next? It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 11th. The McGahn decision and proxy voting. Let's start with an overview. It's been a busy week in the courts for Lawfare-related purposes. Scott, give us a brief overview of what happened in the D.C. Circuit, and then Margaret, give us an equally brief overview of the disposition of the remote voting case.
Sure. Well, the big action that happened this past Friday, August 7th, is that the D.C. Circuit sitting en banc, meaning all the current judges sitting together and deciding the matter together, issued an opinion in the Committee on the Judiciary of the House Judiciary Committee versus Donald McGahn. And this is the decision to determine whether Mr. McGahn could be compelled by a subpoena to testify in relation to the now defunct, or at least now past, impeachment proceedings. But the case is ongoing because of the legal principle underlying it as to whether the White House counsel's former White House counsel can be compelled to testify by a congressional subpoena. There had been a prior decision on this by a panel of 3 judges in February of this year that said essentially the House and the committee and the House as a whole do not have standing, a legal standing, to bring a suit to enforce a subpoena on the grounds of past historical practice and general separations of powers concerns that prevented the courts from intervening in an interbranch dispute like this, that the 2 judges who were in the majority on that panel decision, Judges Henderson and Judge Griffith, felt would undermine the system of accommodation that had traditionally manned this sort of or resolved these sorts of conflicts. Here in this matter, we saw the 7 democratically appointed judges on the court joined together in one opinion authored by Judge Judith Rogers, who was the dissenting judge on the original panel, reversing that opinion, which had already been vacated when they took it up en banc in April, and reaching quite the contrary conclusion, saying that, yes, accommodation is important, but that the accommodation process has always occurred against the backdrop assumption that judicial review was ultimately available as an option, if not an immediately accessible one, and dismissing the standing concerns that the panel opinion had initially used to dispose of the matter. The seven judges, again, democratically appointed judges, all joined that one opinion. Judge Henderson and Judge Griffith both dissented on similar grounds as they had authored in their original panel opinion, and Judge Katsas and Judge Rao, two other Republican appointees by President Trump, did not participate in the matter. So we ended up with a 7-2 decision that is now going to be remanded back to the panel for consideration of certain other related legal issues, both regarding whether it can move forward and the actual merits if they resolve those other issues. A related opinion that had been taken up by the D.C. Circuit en banc in this is a separate decision regarding Mnuchin versus the House Committee. And this was a challenge to the efforts by the administration to reroute certain funds to pay for the president's border wall, which the House alleged was in violation of the Defense Appropriations Act, as well as the Administrative Procedures Act. The D.C. Circuit had kind of decided sua sponte to take up this decision from the district court, kind of bypassing the panel level on the logic that it had been resolved at that level on a very similar, if not identical, standing concern. And in this case, they remanded that They ended up remanding that matter back to the district court for decision in line with this new McGahn decision, which seems to have taken away at least the main standing barriers that the district court had relied on in disposing of that matter earlier on.
All right. And Margaret, there was another case as well, this one involving remote voting with the awesome caption, McCarthy v. Pelosi, which seems like almost more of a metaphor than the name of a case. Tell us about it and what the court found.
Indeed, kind of a political metaphor of sorts.
Cage match.
Yes. So back in May, listeners will recall the House of Representatives passed a resolution which basically was response to the coronavirus pandemic, which allowed the speaker to, you know, in time of emergency or crisis, as advised by the sergeant at arms and others, other sort of non-members in the House, that the speaker can put in place it's really a proxy voting system under which members who aren't able to get to the House or there's danger for them in doing so can basically, you know, send a signed letter to another member of the House, and that member of the House can vote for the person sending the letter. The person sending the letter instructs the other member how the person sending the letter would like to vote. So this is sort of the remote or proxy voting system that the House put in place. There have been a number of actual votes under this system. Lots of Democrats, particularly ones living far away or who are older and at risk of contracting coronavirus and suffering from the effects of it, have utilized the system to instruct other members on how to vote on the floor for them. It's notable that actually one Republican has also utilized the system. But when this system was first put in place, the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, along with scores of other Republican representatives, as well as a handful of their constituents, challenged the constitutionality of this system. And they argued that it violates the Constitution's quorum requirement, the yeas and nays requirement, the non-delegation doctrine, as well as just the structure of the Constitution. And so this case was heard in, as you said, the D.C. District Court, oral argument not long ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago. And Judge Rudolph Contreras in the District Court issued his decision on Thursday. And it's an interesting opinion. It's not decided on the basis of, you know, Article 3 standing per se, although the judge does walk through those arguments a little bit. It is decided instead on the basis of the speech and debate clause of the Constitution, and essentially finds that Speaker Pelosi and the others named in the suit are immune from civil action because they're shielded by the speech and debate clause. This case, this is the first decision in this case. There has been an appeal filed by McCarthy et al. And so we'll see how this progresses as it moves up the chain of higher courts. But it is an interesting one in particular because the judge goes through a number of different types of arguments that are presented, but doesn't rely on them and instead relies on the speech and debate clause immunity decision.
All right, so let's dive in a little more into each of these cases and then talk a little bit about their implications for congressional oversight and functioning in the months and years to come. So first of all, Scott, I'm interested in your thoughts on the very rare partisan breakdown of the D.C. Circuit on the McGahn case. I cannot think of the last time a case was embanked in the D.C. Circuit and resolved on the basis of a strict ideological split where the kind of Democratic appointed judges behaved one way and the Republican appointed judges behaved another way. This is somewhat not in keeping with the culture of the court, at least since the mid-90s. And the court, of course, disfavors en bancs altogether. So I'm interested, is this an example of a sort of newly ideologically divided D.C. Circuit in the Trump era? Or is this an example instead of a truly outlying panel that was rolled back by the unanimous court, except that two of the judges, the two judges most likely to agree with them, were recused? Or is it somewhere in between? How do you understand the division of the en banc court here?
It's certainly notable that we saw the seven judges who are the Democratic appointees on the court, although I'm not sure that's necessarily the deciding factor. But it is notable that all seven judges in the majority all joined one opinion, and that one opinion was authored by Judge Rogers, who, again, was the dissenter in the initial panel opinion. I think it's hard to read that as anything other than a pretty clear effort to rebuke the panel opinion's original decision. There's a lot of symbolic significance there. There's lots of other issues that individual judges could have stepped aside and filed a concurrence and said, I want to explore this a little more. I'm not sure I agree with this. And that's not that unusual in en banc decisions. You think of things like the Ballul en banc that had something like 10 or 11 individual opinions, one of the Ballul en bancs, I should say. It's not unusual to get those sorts of complex concurrences in really complicated and divisive cases. And that did not happen here. And I strongly suspect that that was very deliberate, because this is deciding a controversial issue that at least that segment of the court feels like they have a unified stance on. And this pretty clearly establishes that until the judges change, that's the view of the D.C. Circuit. So unless the Supreme Court takes it up or new judges come on, and the only judge that we expect to come on is somebody to replace Judge Griffith, meaning it's not going to change the seven-judge block that supports this view, this is how they feel on these increasingly important legislative standing issues, at least in this context, the context of a subpoena. So that's really notable. I also don't know if we know for sure how Rao and Katsas would have come down on this narrow issue of standing. We have to remember that the first time that we really saw this question of the House's standing to pursue certain types of litigation was in a challenge to the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, launched by the Republican House of Representatives. And that was very controversial at the time. A lot of progressive-leaning commentators were very skeptical of the standing case there. And so it's not clear to me that Rao and Katsas, who are of this newer generation of kind of post-Trump, or at least more recent vintage of conservative judges, would necessarily agree with Henderson and Griffith, who are much of a much older school, and were very united in this very strong view that the courts just should stay out of these interbranch disputes. That is a similar sentiment that we've seen losing in other areas of court jurisprudence. The biggest example that is actually cited by Judge Rogers in her opinion, and kind of a telling provision by analogy, kind of almost, is the Zivotofsky case, Zivotofsky v. Clinton, I should say, the first Zivotofsky case in the Supreme Court in 2012, which is where we saw the Supreme Court pretty substantially narrow the political question doctrine, which was the tool that was used by a whole generation, if not multiple generations of judges, to stay out of these disputes. And in that case, over the dissent of Justice Breyer, who felt that didn't like having judicial involvement here. So there may be, as much as there may be a partisan split, there may be a little bit of a generational split over how the courts and judges think about their relationship to the separation of powers and the propriety of judicial involvement in interbranch disputes between Congress and the presidency.
And so how did Judge Rogers, on behalf of this very strong group of seven judges, how did she reason this? What are the circumstances, in her view, in which legislative standing does and does not exist to do things like enforce a subpoena?
She really takes an approach to this question of standing that is treats the Congress and the committee in a very similar position as other sorts of plaintiffs in other lawsuits, looking at the three requirements of standing, which is, you know, an injury in fact, attribution to the actual injury being linked to the individuals, in the defendants in this case, and then redressability, the ability to have a remedy that can actually solve the injury that's alleged.
Okay, but before you go on, let's pause there and walk through. So what does she find the injury in fact is? What does she find the redressability of that injury is? And what does she find the attributability to defendants' actions is quite obvious here, but, you know, walk us through the elements as she finds it.
She spends the vast majority of her time on the injury in fact prong, because that was in a way what was most in dispute, or at least the subsequent two elements flow very easily to the conclusion of there being standing if you establish there is injury in fact in this case. And they basically said, the Judge Rogers basically said, for the seven judges, look, this is a case where the committee and the House are acting to try and secure something that is necessary for their constitutional role. And they're damaged by having an inability to do that. In this case, it's a subpoena to get information. And she goes on to describe how the Congress has used subpoenas to get information for legislative purposes. And they've also used it to get information in relation to impeachment, which is the context here and is very clear congressional authority that the House has in addition to its straight legislative authority. And that's really notable. And said essentially, if you go through the breakdown, that's very clearly there's a constitutional responsibility here. We have good established historical practice of them needing information here. She also notes that private plaintiffs can sue when the government withholds information, citing informational injury cases that the D.C. Circuit has had, the Supreme Court has had, like FCC v. Aikens, and similar standing cases that are a notable exception to an otherwise very strict move in standing over the last 20 or 30 years. And she essentially concluded, well, of course there's an injury here. And from there, she did away actually with the subsequent two prongs of standing in just two paragraphs, saying they flow very naturally from this conclusion. The way Griffith had reached the counter conclusion is that he had looked very strongly to historical practice and had said, well, look, there's really no history of the presidency and the Congress coming to the courts for resolution of a dispute like this, where there's a subpoena between these two cases or between these two parties, and that where they need a resolution. Instead, he said, well, they always negotiated before. And because Congress is, or the courts have never addressed a case like this before, it's not clear that they have the authority to do that, or that there's a sort of injury because there's no underlying right to have these authorities vindicated by the courts. And he relied very heavily on that historical practice point. Judge Rogers flips the historical practice. She points out, and I think this is correct, is that, well, maybe the court never actually resolved, was forced to come to the resolution on one side or the other of these prior cases. But the whole accommodation process that both parties, every member of the court values in this, always occurred against the backdrop assumption that a judicial remedy would ultimately be available, or at least could ultimately be available, and that that was inherently part of the incentives and background against which the two branches had previously negotiated accommodated, and that if you were to pull that out, that would be disrupting the historical accommodation process much more than leaving in this possibility of judicial resolution. That, and so there's really underlying this between Judge Griffith and Judge Rogers is a fundamentally different understanding about how the accommodation process operates and how it relates to the judicial role in these sorts of separation of powers disputes.
All right. So, Margaret, when the panel decision came down, I believe we had a podcast in which you were quite despondent over it and said, you know, if this stands, it is a real blow to the capacity of Congress to do oversight. Are you elated by this opinion, or is there reason to be less excited about it than would initially appear?
So I would say that I'm not elated by it because it's very narrow. All it says is that there is standing for Article III courts to consider these issues. It does not go into the merits of other types of arguments that will surely be made in connection with this case, when it goes back to the panel. The court decision in particular says, all it says is the committee has Article III standing to seek enforcement in federal court of its duly issued subpoena in the performance of its constitutional responsibilities. And it affirms that. And then it says consideration of McGahn's other contentions, including threshold pre-merits objections that there is no subject matter jurisdiction and no applicable cause of action, and potential consideration of the merits, if reached, remain to be decided and are remanded to the panel to address in the first instance. So, you know, at best, what we have here is a long process ahead of us where that panel is going to consider all these other issues. By the way, it's hard to see this case advancing from that panel. So that's at best. At worst, what we have is, this will be disposed of quite quickly by the lower court, and that will stand. So despite various members of Congress sort of celebrating this, and there are some reasons to celebrate, it is so procedural, it's so threshold that a lot remains to be seen about what the court really thinks the scope of legislative inquiry, proper scope of legislative inquiry is. And that's, we haven't even gotten to the issue of executive privilege. This case is only about, quote, absolute immunity or, quote, testimonial immunity. We're not even talking about the issue of executive privilege, which can be litigated sort of point by point if McGahn ever does get to the point where he has to physically show up. I mean, he could physically show up to Congress having, lost all of these cases all the way up to Supreme Court or whatever, and then he could just begin asserting executive privilege with respect to, every question that he has asked. So it's not a cause for jubilation. It represents a very, I'd say, important but incremental step in defining the scope of what the court will allow the legislative branch to do.
And yet, I recall that at oral argument in this case, they argued the merits along with the jurisdictional questions when it was before the panel. And I recall that even Griffith had no time for the government's arguments on the merits. I remember tweeting after the oral argument, if the government wins this, it'll be on jurisdiction. Do you think it's likely to get bogged down in further? I agree with you on the executive privilege point, but I see a relatively clear path here to resolving the absolute testimonial immunity question. Do you not?
I just think it's unclear. I think that in particular, Griffith, he just has a real allergy to the court wading into this. And I do suspect that the panel may look to other modes of jurisprudence, maybe to turn this down and get rid of it. But I think it's hard to say. And it's even harder to say on what kind of timeline this might happen.
All right. So let's talk about the subsidiary case here, Mnuchin, for a moment. Scott, is there any reason to think Mnuchin will not be controlled by the disposition in McGann?
That's a good question. I don't believe so. One doesn't jump out immediately. I mean, it is a little bit of a different context. In that case, it is a substantive challenge, you know, as to the compliance with a statute, whereas this is compliance with a subpoena. And so there might be a distinction there. Certainly the fact that the en banc court remanded it on the assumption that this resolved the issue seems to imply that that's not a sufficient grounds for distinguishing that. And I think Judge Rogers' opinion implies as much. So it seems likely that the district court at least is going to feel a lot of pressure to move past that particular part of the issue and then move on getting into any other preliminary matters that might still be pending and getting to the resolution of the underlying statute, which of course is the border wall. In that case, though, it really hinges upon the election. If President Trump loses, the next administration is not going to keep trying to build that border wall. There will be a new defense appropriations bill. There will be new funding in place. I think there's a good chance you'll see a lot of the alleged injuries be reversed to the extent they can by the subsequent administration. And therefore, a lot of litigation will become moot. And maybe they'll have some success in saying, well, there's a chance this could be repeated. And therefore, we need to keep litigating out the rights here in the executive branch. Who knows exactly what position they'll come down on? I suspect they might walk back a lot of legal opinions of this administration. But we don't know for sure. And I think there's going to be lots of avenues by which that matter will drop off. And therefore, you won't ever actually have to get to resolution of the merits. The same is probably true in McGann as well, to some extent, at least. In this case, the McGann decision, they remanded it back to the panel opinion to resolve these additional questions of whether there's a cause of action and whether there's subject matter jurisdiction, which the court quite explicitly did not reach. But then we saw the two members of the panel opinion, Henderson and Griffith, include in their dissents basically that they don't think a cause of action or subject matter jurisdiction exists. So we know how the panel opinion is going to come out there, and it's likely going to have to come back en banc if the matter isn't mooted by then. Perhaps part of the reason why they didn't feel the need to reach those issues now and were willing to remand to the panel is because the assumption is that there's a good chance they will be mooted and the court will never actually have to reach them. Conveniently, that also makes it less likely that this decision will be taken up by the Supreme Court and subjected to further review there. Because again, there's lots of other ways this matter could go away before any sort of final resolution. So, you know, in all these opinions, it's less about the actual individual case at this point, this close to the election, which is how most people are thinking about the case, saying, are we going to hear McGann testify? Are we going to see the border wall project reverse? It's much more about the legal principles being established and what incentives those provide for future actors in similar cases.
All right. Let's go back to the proxy voting case. If I were a cynical Republican here, I would say the courts here established in these cases the idea that Democrats can sue and Republicans can't. I'm being cynical there, but it does seem a little bit odd for within a day or so of Democratic-controlled committees and legislators being able to sue to enforce the subpoenas, Republicans are not able to sue to stop this proxy voting stuff. Were they found to have standing or were and lost on the merits, or did Judge Contreras simply skip over the standing questions, and how did he handle them?
So it's a really good question. The interesting answer is that I think wisely, and I probably would have done the same thing, Judge Contreras explores the standing question, but doesn't decide the case on that argument. And basically what he says, he starts to go through the three-prong standing analysis and starts with injury in fact, and basically says, look, the system that this resolution sets up, proxy voting, it's not clear to me that there is an injury in fact. And then he sort of leaves it there and says, but, you know, I need not decide that question because I'm not basing this decision on that doctrine. So he doesn't touch standing sort of with a 10-foot pole except to say, not sure there's really any injury here based on how the proxy voting system is set up. So then he moves to the second argument that Pelosi and her lawyers made in court, which is that the Raines case, Raines v. Byrd, controls in this. And, you know, basically that means that the case can't move forward. Goes through that analysis and essentially says, you know, not clear to me that the Raines case is going to control here, because there's this other case in the D.C. Circuit called Michelle v. Anderson, which the court did take up and consider a voting dilution case, which is what, in this case, the McCarthy et al. Had argued, that their votes were being diluted, and then says, but I need not decide this case on this ground either. I don't have to come down either way because I'm not deciding based on that, the Raines decision, which I should note was an inter-branch dispute. What we have here is an intra-branch dispute, meaning you have members of the House representatives suing each other. In the Raines case, it was a different set of considerations that involved separation of powers and the presidency. So he kind of walks through those issues and, you know, says, these are issues that are out there, but I'm not deciding the case on that. And instead moves to this sort of petition debate clause analysis, which is kind of a separate doctrine, and decides that this case called Consumers Union, which is a D.C. Circuit case from 1975, controls here and basically says that enforcing internal rules of Congress validly enacted under authority specifically granted to Congress enjoys protection under the speech and debate clause. So he really looks to this whole separate, you know, line of cases and doctrine that specifically relate to the speech and debate clause.
All right. So I have so many problems with this analysis that I don't know where to start. But the first one is, he skates over a standing question in order to reach substantive law on the speech and debate clause. And, you know, I'm kind of old school about this. You're kind of not supposed to reach the merits if you don't have jurisdiction over a case in the first place. And so my question is, if this goes up to the D.C. Circuit, doesn't the D.C. Circuit take one look at this and say, and which is maybe just as good from Pelosi's perspective, you know, Kevin McCarthy, what kind of injury in fact do you have here? Get out of court altogether.
It's a good question. It's possible that that's what they will do, unless they are looking to kind of get rid of this thing, just like Contreras was. There, I think, is some kind of argument that McCarthy et al. Can make regarding injury in fact and the other prongs of standing. This is something Scott and I have talked about. I don't think the vote dilution theory is very convincing, but, you know, one could argue that there are sort of more intangible things about being present in the House of Representatives for a vote that, you know, the founders, that, you know, they really were committed to the idea that people needed to get together, members needed to get together, be talking to each other, persuading each other. So there are other kinds potentially of injury in fact that could be argued, but Contreras doesn't address them here.
I'm sorry. I don't buy that. Let me, you know, all right. I am Kevin McCarthy, and Nancy Pelosi has forced through a rule, leave aside that I think the rules of the House are quite molten core political question doctrine stuff, as in it is literally textually committed to the House to make its own rules. But she forces through a rule that says Representative Margaret Taylor, if she's afraid of COVID, gets to send me her vote and I can vote for her pursuant to the following rules. And Representative Kevin McCarthy says maybe he has standing if he can say, you know, Representative Margaret Taylor's vote was decisive and I am injured because but for this proxy vote, I would have prevailed on this vote, but I didn't. I lost because Nancy Pelosi forced through this rule. But under normal circumstances, if you can't allege that, how is he less well off as a result of this rule change? And what business does Judge Contreras have ruling on the scope of the speech and debate clause instead of saying, I'm sorry, bucko, you don't have an injury in fact. And besides, if you did, it's, you know, whatever diffuse injury you're claiming about the kind of spirit of the House and togetherness and all that, it's not really clear that it's attributable to anything associated with this rule. You guys all hate each other and don't like spending time in the same room anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I do think that it's interesting to me that Judge Contreras did walk through these other arguments in some detail before, you know, sort of saying, well, I'm not going to decide it. I sense in the opinion, and I don't know Judge Contreras's work all that well, but I sense an uncertainty about how the D.C. Circuit and potentially the en banc D.C. Circuit, maybe the Supreme Court, might handle this kind of case. And so it's interesting. I think he's laying it all out there, even these things he doesn't find to be dispositive in the case, because there may be some uncertainty about how a higher court will look at this. And a higher court may very well look at it the same way you are looking at it, Ben, in which case Judge Contreras may be back, you know, fleshing out the standing issues in some detail, et cetera. So it is an interesting opinion. If I'm Judge Contreras, I might even do the same thing, because if you step back and look at all of the litigation going on in court regarding, you know, standing for the legislature, how far the Supreme Court and lower courts are going to sort of reach into the legislative branch's process, how they're going to, you know, mediate disputes or not between the legislative branch and the executive branch. I mean, it's all kind of a big mess. And we've got the Mazars decision came down recently. So there's all these cases that are sort of trickling down. And I would say almost reordering or reforming how we think about these basic normative questions of, are courts going to resolve disputes between the executive and the legislative branch? Are courts going to involve themselves in the internal rulemaking processes of Congress? So I guess I would say in some ways it's understandable that he is feeling maybe a little bit uncertain about how this might be handled by a higher court.
What do you think, Scott? This shows up at the D.C. Circuit. Do you think there's any panel of the D.C. Circuit that doesn't tell McCarthy to take a hike on standing grounds?
I actually think there is, although it is not the argument that McCarthy and other folks kind of advanced here, which is they relied on this voter dilution bet. They hinted at other arguments actually in their kind of initial complaint, but they seem to have landed on this voter dilution as their strongest one, which I would query, because I actually think that argument's particularly weak. You have to bear in mind that, you know, on a standing argument, you are supposed to assume that the law and facts, as the plaintiff kind of alleged in their complaint, are accurate, right? So it doesn't mean if they're wrong on the law, then they'll lose on the merits. But at standing, you assume they're basically correct. And here you would say, well, okay, assuming that the Constitution actually does require in-person attendance by members of Congress, how does it injure these individuals that that is no longer required? And I think you can see ways where they can make an argument about that. The clearest one to me that Margaret kind of alluded to, because we had a conversation about this before, is to say, well, look, when I'm not in the same building as my peers, I don't have an opportunity to advocate to them, to engage with them, to lobby with them. And that hurts me because I can't as easily engage with them. I don't have the opportunity to pin them down in a hallway or to force them to show up at committee meetings where I know they're going to be, or at least are supposed to be, and confront them over these sorts of incidents. Is that a winning argument? I'm not sure it is. But I can see why, from Contreras' perspective, you're like, well, getting into this around this sorts of injury and fact questions might be a little tricky because it might not, even though they've kind of pled it one way that's problematic, we may not want to get down onto an argument to say, well, certain things are injuries or aren't injuries, that it's much more fact specific and it's harder to get guidance from. I think the same goes, honestly, if you're thinking about the Raines case. The Raines case has become really, really integral and kind of controversial over the last 10 years, 9 years since we saw the ACA challenge really first bring these legislative standing issues to the fore. And a lot of parties, including the president in the McGahn case, rely upon this very broad reading of Raines. I should say McGahn in the McGahn case, excuse me, not the president, but the president's side, rely upon an incredibly broad reading of Raines is basically ruling out all sorts of legislative standing. It's very clear Contreras thinks it's a narrower view. He sees that Raines is really relating primarily to, again, as Margaret mentioned, interbranch disputes, not intra-branch disputes. And then we saw in the McGahn decision, the broader D.C. Circuit actually taking a much narrower view of Raines insofar as it only limits actually individual legislative standing in regards to legislation, at least. Maybe that would also apply here. We're not sure. But doesn't prevent legislative body standing, which is what is at issue there. So sticking his neck into that decision, again, makes it one of these things that might pop up again. Speech and debate is kind of a closet merits resolution in my mind. He basically says, well, speech and debate protects all sorts of legitimate exercises and views on the House floor about how Congress exercises a bunch of its legislative authority, and has a line in there that says essentially, and of course, you know, Congress has the ability to make its own rules, so there's no reason to think this doesn't fall into that. That's the issue the question at issue in this case. Like, that's really the merits. He just gets at it through this kind of backdoor speech and debate clause way. I found it very counterintuitive. I don't know if I find it the best way. I would have much rather he just reach the merits and get there. But I suspect, again, I think there's a little bit of gamesmanship here, as Margaret alluded. And he thinks, well, maybe, you know, in giving this non-win-win to the House, it doesn't actually interrupt any sorts of these ongoing actions. It can still continue to function in this epidemic, but it doesn't provoke or give such a black eye to House Republicans that they'll feel compelled to continue to pursue the litigation. And that's, as far as I know, is something we're still waiting to see, is whether they'll actually appeal this. I think it's a good chance they don't, because I'm not sure it actually serves their political ends. And particularly as the epidemic has continued to get worse, it doesn't look like a great position for them to be taking up as championing the in-person non-mask wearing kind of contingent.
Actually, they did decide to appeal. They
Oh, I missed that. Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Well, never mind then.
The whole thing is too clever by half, in my view. I would be very surprised if the DC Circuit does not affirm but vacate this opinion because they don't have standing. And if they reach the merits, the much cleaner resolution, as Scott points out, is there is an affirmative textual commitment of authority to the House of Representatives to make its own rule. And, you know, short of a overtly discriminatory rule, I don't know, that, you know, all members of the House can vote except, you know, Jewish members or whatever, I can't imagine the rules of the House being justiciable.
On the merits, I 100% agree. But I think it should be a merits decision, not necessarily these strange standing dodges that this Judge Contreras seems to be inclined to pursue, or speech and debate dodges.
That's what I mean. I think it's a I think it's an initial instance. It's a standing decision. And if you reach the merits, do it cleanly. Just treat it as a non-justiciable commitment of power to the House to make its own rules. And if Kevin McCarthy doesn't like the rules that the House has adopted under Nancy Pelosi, he can win an election and change them. I don't know. I'm being grouchy in my conservatism about this, but this seems to me like a very easy case.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how the D.C. Circuit handles it, presumably, unless it's mooted by that time because of a new Congress. I do just want to note before we move off this particular case, there is a footnote 6 in Contreras' opinion, which speaks
to... We got to focus on footnote 6. Yeah. There's always a footnote 6.
Exactly. How is that? But it does say that, you know, this case does not present something that clearly deprives members of votes on a discriminatory basis. Therefore, the court need not decide whether immunity would apply in such a case. So he does sort of allude to that in a footnote that there is this potential outer limit that he views as there being on this speech and debate clause immunity.
Yeah, I think, and there, you know, whether you frame it as a speech or debate clause or you frame it as a political question, surely if Nancy Pelosi had issued a rule that said, you know, all members can vote proxy voting for COVID-19 except members of the Congressional Black Caucus, I think, you know, whatever theory you get used to get to the fact that the courts have no business in this would presumably give way under such extreme circumstances.
I think that's right. And I just want to say, you know, I think standing doctrine by the Supreme Court, it's so, you know, judges will just sort of look at standing and sort of do whatever they want. And they'll use the standing doctrine when that helps them. They will ignore it when it doesn't necessarily help them. It's really points, I think, to a broader confusion in the Supreme Court standing doctrine generally. And I think it's an area of the law that is kind of ripe for disruption, is something that just doesn't provide a lot of predictability on whether Article III courts are going to take up issues or not.
All right, we're going to wrap up. But before we do, I just want to pose the question, what's next? So we've talked about what happens next in these cases, but what are the other major Congress litigations, Congress v. executive, or Congresses in this case, Congress v. Congress litigations that are still kicking around and yet to be decided, arising out of the various crazinesses that we have going on?
Well, I'll take a little stab at that. And my first answer is one word, mootness, because a lot of these issues could very well be mooted, as I said earlier, when there is a new Congress. If they're not, then, you know, I think there's just a lot of more machination to happen. So as you and I have, we've all talked about in the context of the Mazars case, you know, Supreme Court Justice Roberts issues an opinion saying, well, you know, the lower courts need to go back and maybe gather more facts and think about these four, you know, factors on separation of powers when considering the Mazars Deutsche Bank cases. In the McGahn decision, there's obviously going to be a lot more machination there. Proxy voting, or this case we've just been discussing, Judge Contreras's opinion, it's going to go up the chain, presumably. So I think the future holds machination and potential mootness. But, and this will be the last thing I'll say, there are major questions being decided here, and they will be important going forward. So in the Mazars case, the Supreme Court did basically say congressional subpoenas are a thing, and they do potentially have power. That was a new thing. The Supreme Court had never really opined in that way. In the McGahn case, you have a court saying there isn't such a thing as absolute immunity or testimonial immunity. If that holds, that will be important going forward. That will be the starting point for future presidents in the arguments that they make.
Scott?
Yeah, I'll take up that last point of Margaret's and amplify it a little bit and maybe contextualize it. You know, I do think in the McGahn case and in the Mazars case, actually, which the McGahn case really interesting relies on the logic of, even though it's not directly applicable, but that you see a similar logic in both decisions, and notably, you know, a 7-judge decision of DC Circuit of Democratic justices, 7-justice decision in the Supreme Court with mixed both Republican and Democratic justices, where they do not seem to be afraid the same way Judge Griffith and Judge Henderson were about the judiciary being involved in these separation of powers disputes. They value accommodation. They value the branches exercising self-help and reaching accommodation. But both decisions share this common logic, which is that a judicial role of some sort, staking out core principles that they're supposed to be reaching accommodation around, and ultimately some threat of judicial enforcement at some point, potentially, although admittedly down a very long road that many people may find dissatisfying, provides important incentives to push towards accommodation around more principled grounds. And that's a very different vision than Judge Griffith, Judge Henderson, and frankly, the president and many of the president's allies have been advocating for, which is a much more no-holds-barred, pugilistic vision of the separation of powers, where each of the political branches beats the other one into submission when it has the opportunity, with no real incentive for accommodation, at least in my view, once you have the power to actually force submission by the other party. You know, there was a real risk that that was the vision that was going to win out in some of this litigation, in my view. Certainly, that was the advocacy angle taken on by the president and many of his allies. And we've seen that lose out to one where the court is saying, these are issues that are ultimately are resolvable on constitutional grounds by a judiciary. And that changes the incentive structure. And I think that's actually a pretty fundamental change, or pretty maybe a fundamental affirmation about how the courts are going to engage around these issues in the future. And while I tend to agree that I don't think we're going to see the judiciary suddenly start enforcing these subpoenas systematically or a narrow timeframe, it doesn't change the game on such direct terms. The broader incentives and the broader threat of judicial intervention does, I think, adjust the terms of the game a little bit and push back against the much more absolutist brinksmanship style that the president and his counsel and his various allies have been pursuing in recent litigation. I think that's interesting and historically could be significant. And frankly, I think it's a good thing in the long run for how we think about the separation of powers.
We're going to leave it there. Scott Anderson, Margaret Taylor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the Right Honorable Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, so tweet us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit, and, you know, make TikTok videos about us while you still can before TikTok goes away and, you know, making a video becomes a matter for sanctions. You can get your Lawfare merch, for which you will not be sanctioned but praised, at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.